From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Most of us know the story of the whale ship Essex, or we think we know it, how it was sunk in 1819 by a huge and furious sperm whale. At least we know the whale part of the story because it inspired the book Moby Dick. But the sinking of the Essex really was just the starting point of the real story, a story Nathaniel Philbrick told so brilliantly some 15 years ago in his book In the Heart of the Sea. It won the National Book Award, and it's now been made into a major motion picture, which just gives us the opportunity to have Philbrick tell us the story, how 8 of the crew of 20 managed to survive, and only because they ate the bodies of their dead shipmates. Philbrick describes this story as a terrible laboratory experiment devised to see just how far the human animal could go in its battle against the sea. Join us after the news.
Still thinking about that conversation on StoryCorps? Or the story you caught last weekend on Snap Judgment? The voices you hear on public radio stay with you. You can have a lasting effect on public radio, too. KUER sustainers give ongoing monthly contributions, providing a steady stream of income so we can continue to bring you the programs you can't get out of your head. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So here's the plot for Ron Howard's new movie opening this weekend. A Nantucket whale ship called the Essex was on a hunting voyage in the South Pacific when it was rammed by an immense and very angry sperm whale. In some accounts, this whale was 85 feet long. Now, just take a moment and imagine that, if in fact the creature was even close to that size. And the whale rammed the ship not once, but twice. The second time, it sunk the vessel. And it left the crew of 20 in 3 small whaling boats, about as far away from land as you could be in the ocean. They made for South America, about 3,000 miles away, and for 3 months they were stranded. 8 survived, and only because they ate the bodies of their dead shipmates. It's a great plot for a movie, right? Well, it's an even better book. It is, of course, the real-life story told in Nathaniel Philbrick's In the Heart of the Sea, which has become a classic, really. It won the National Book Award. The film, though, is the excuse we're using to have Nathaniel Philbrick back on the program to talk about this amazing story, so that's what we're doing. His book is In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex. Philbrick is the author of numerous books, including Mayflower, Why Read Moby Dick? In the Heart of the Sea was published in 2000, we'll tell you a little bit more about the film, which is opening this weekend. He has a new book coming out next year about George Washington and Benedict Arnold and the American Revolution, and Philbrick is joining us today from the studios of Carnegie Hall in New York City. Nathaniel Philbrick, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's great to be back.
Well, we don't need to spend a lot of time with the movie, although I kind of want to hear some things about it, but what is it like to have this story you have, I won't say obsessed over, but certainly thought a lot about and written a lot about?
Yeah, I obsessed over it.
Okay, yeah. Good. What's it like to see it on the screen?
It's kind of an out-of-body experience. I wrote the book more than 15 years ago, and it had been optioned way back when it came out in 2000, but I had given up on it actually becoming a movie. That's the fate of most books that are optioned. Nothing ever happens. And very quickly it came together at this belated time. And it's funny. It's, I wrote the book so long ago that to have it come back to life has really brought back the circumstances under which I wrote it, when my kids were still at home and I was younger and all those things. So it's nostalgia, but it's also just an amazing experience to watch something that I did obsess about for several years take this visual life. It's just kind of incredible.
You know, when I think about the way this story has been told over time, including your telling of it, I think about and Melville's telling of it, frankly, the way he took elements of this, of course, and put it in Moby Dick, which you and I have talked about. I wonder if you worried about, in the conversation with Ron Howard or whomever you talked about as you were talking about whether this should be a film, if they would properly tell it, because it's not just about a big whale, and it's not just about starving men. I mean, it has these bigger themes in it. You got that, and I think certainly Melville got that too.
Well, I think any author whose book is turned into a movie, you know, has concerns about that translation. And I have to say, once I knew that Ron Howard was involved, my concerns were eased considerably. And then it was just, let's see, it was in the winter of 2013. I talked with Ron, who by that time had, you know, initially read the script, but by that time had read my book. And, you know, and it was a huge relief to realize, you know, that this was someone who was really trying to be true to the story, the essence of the story. And what was really gratifying was that he had a real interest in visually evoking in the movie Moby Dick. He felt that, the prism we all come to in the 21st century to this story is through Melville's masterpiece. Yeah. And he saw a real opportunity to resonate through it, and he had very specific questions, and so it, for me it was, I said I think he's getting it, and I'm happy to say he got it.
Well, you must be delighted by the fact that he went through that filter of Moby Dick, because you've written about that. Why Moby Dick?
Yeah.
Is so important. It's in our genetic code. You've said.
Exactly. And Ron found that book, Why Read Moby Dick, very helpful. And, in the movie, Melville is a character. And so, that was really cool to me. And my dad is a retired English professor whose specialty was in maritime literature. And Moby Dick was a book he taught just about every year. Yeah. And in talking with him about this process, he said, Melville stole shamelessly from the story of the Essex when he wrote Moby Dick. It's really great that someone who is creating a movie about the Essex is, not stealing but evoking Moby Dick. You know, it's just there is a real justice there.
Mm. Well, you write about in The Heart of the Sea how your father, as you said, a professor of English, put you and your brother to bed from time to time with this story. So what do you remember of those? How did he tell it when he told it?
Well, yeah, it's kind of amazing my brother and I are not in constant therapy after being told a bedtime story involving a whale sinking a ship. Well, maybe this book is my version of that therapy. But what he would tell us is, it wasn't anything about starvation or anything like that. It was the story of a whale ramming a ship, and which was really cool for a little kid. And it wasn't until I was well along, if not middle school, and begin to realize, whoa, this had something to do with Moby Dick. And being a teenager in the 60s and 70s, I anything my father thought was cool was really stupid. And so the thought of having to read Moby Dick was not anything I looked to with relish. And as a senior in AP English, I had to read Moby Dick. Yeah. And sure enough, I read that first sentence, "Call me Ishmael," and I was harpooned. I mean, this was a text that spoke to me in so many ways. And so it's moving to Nantucket and discovering the story of the Essex on my own terms has really been, I guess, a real turning of the wheel.
You lay out in the book what it was that you wanted to know, because there are some very basic things you get at, and I want to get to some of these things. One of them is you say you wanted to know why a big whale like this acted like it did. So. I want to spend some time with that. We'll get to that. You wanted to know what it meant to really be thirsty, like what it meant to be on the verge of dying of thirst, and what it meant to be starving, to be really, really, really hungry. I think what's interesting about that to me anyway, and also the cannibalism part, was that interested you, it seems like, not just for the sensational part of it. It's a pretty gruesome story, but it's the psychology of that story that seems to have interested you, like how their minds were working, how they interacted. And I mean, that's a lot about what In the Heart of the Sea is about, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, what excited me about the story, because I had written about the story in my first work of history, A Way Offshore, which is a history of Nantucket. And you know, I had told that story in the context of the island's history. And when I began to envision In the Heart of the Sea, what was liberating about it was that I wanted to move beyond a regional tale of whaling and elevate this to something about the human condition and man's position in nature and the world and all that kind of thing. And when I started to think of it in those terms, I had all these questions. You know, what was really going on a physiological level, mm-hmm. a psychological level? The whale itself was such a mystery. And, you know, my books, I don't write my books because I'm an expert in the topic. I write the book because I have questions and I want to learn about the topic. And so this was for me something where a story I had written about seemed completely new and I had all these questions and I wanted to learn about it and use the information I gleaned to help build up suspense, to so that the reader is turning the pages to find out what happens, but in the process is learning.
Let's talk about class. I mean, there's class in this story. There's race in this story. The mechanics of leadership play out. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot of social dynamics here. Let's talk about Nantucket. Because it's a very – this is the thing that was so striking to me rereading the book this week, just how isolated a culture Nantucket. Well, I mean, you think about New England or you think about, you know, Martha's Vineyard and you think about Cape Cod. They're all one thing, but they absolutely were not in those days. And Nantucket was its own culture with its own lingo, with its own accent even, almost its own dialect almost.
Exactly. It was an island with a 30-mile moat around it and, you know, beside the Atlantic. And this, from the beginning, it was founded, the English settlement was founded by a handful of families that basically fled Puritan New England. Some of them were Quakers. Some of them were sympathetic to what the Puritans termed religious radicals. They just wanted to get away from the big brother of Puritanism. And the best way to do that was to purchase this island, an island that was actually an island full of Indians. There were 3,000 Native Americans living on the island at the time. Huge number, given the small size of the island. But for them, it was a place to get away from their brethren on the mainland and go their own way. And they began as sheep farmers. There were no wolves on this island, which was unique in New England, but quickly realized that all these right whales that appeared on the south shore of the island come fall were a real resource. The natives had been doing what was known as drift whaling, a whale that died or became stranded. They would harvest it, boil down the blubber, and had started an oil business with the New Englanders on the mainland. And the Nantucketers learned the craft of whaling and employed the local Wampanoag, the Native Americans, as crew. And they had, for them, a cheap labor supply. Mm-hmm. And then in the early 1700s, just as whaling was beginning to take off, Mary Starbuck became a Quaker, convinced that she should become a Quaker. And there had been a few random Quakers on the island, but when Mary Starbuck, who was looked to as sort of the person on the island already, there was a strong ethic of strong women. When she became a Quaker, most of the island became Quaker. Right. And so they were not only whalemen, not only descended from the same few families, but they were Quakers. And so they had this identity that was so cohesive that no other place in New England could compare to it. And it was different. It was strange.
Yeah.
You know, Quakers are pacifists when it comes to the human race. When it came to whales, they had a very different attitude.
Very.
Melville called them Quakers with vengeance.
Exactly.
And, you know, and it's so quintessentially American, this sort of spirituality combined with this sense of violence. And you know, they looked to the ocean as this wilderness that would make them rich. And, you know, it was the story that would become the American West more than 100 years before.
I think one of the things that I was – I don't think I had realized or I didn't encounter it in the same way when I first read the book. But as I said, rereading it again, it occurred to me just how sad a story it was for animals. And you got a sense that the Quakers and all – I'm guessing probably most people who did whaling didn't really have much of a concern for the tortoises, for example. It's hard to read some of these stories about them going to the Galapagos and just getting hundreds of tortoises and throwing them into the ship.
They believed, along with pretty much anybody in America at that time, they were good Christians that believed the Lord had made nature something that would serve their needs.
Yeah.
And there's a poem, a Quaker poem I cite in the first chapter of In the Heart of the Sea. And I'm happy to say that Ron Howard decided to have a group of Quakers reciting this poem in the early part of the movie.
Oh, that's
and
great.
I'm actually one of the Quakers.
Oh, so, good.
which is kind of fun. But it's by and he what he's saying is, you know, oh, Lord, you've given us commands of the oceans. And it is our job to go out and face this mighty whale to feed our families. And it's this sense that it's a God-given right. And, you know, they did not see themselves as slaughtering the most magnificent creatures on the earth or in the oceans. They saw themselves as risking great hazard to provide the world with light. And but inherent in this attitude was just, you know, they began fishing for right whales off the south coast of Nantucket. Within a matter of decades, they had fished them out. Their ships became bigger. They went north up to almost to the Arctic Circle, fished them out. They went to the west coast of Africa in the years prior to the American Revolution, fished them out. And by the other side of the Revolution, they had rounded the Horn and were working their way up the west coast of South America, and once again fishing them out. This was what they did, and there was always a new whale ground to be discovered. And as you said, one of the real disturbing revelations of writing In the Heart of the Sea was to really get to understand and know how they use Galapagos tortoises.
Yeah.
The Galapagos were the perfect provisioning stop for a Nantucket whale ship. A Galapagos tortoise averages about 80 pounds, but they can get much larger. They can live for more than a year with no food or water, and provide the crew with wonderful fat and oil and meat. And so, you know, it was perfect for them. But so they would round up these tortoises, stack them like cordwood in the hold of the ship, even leave some of them to wander the deck. And off they would go with these tortoises as providing them with their food. And so, you know, as they killed whales, 40 to 50 whales a voyage, ripping the blubber off them, peeling them like an orange, and then boiling that oil into the oil that they then stored in the hold. And so, you know, they were just working through nature. And but it was to serve their Lord and provide for their families.
Yeah. It's interesting the way the culture adapted to these voyages that were sometimes 3 and 4. Well, did they get to be 4 years? I mean, they were 2 and 3 years long anyway, these voyages.
Right. They would when the Essex went down, that was very early in Pacific whaling.
Right.
And so the voyages were breaking into the 2 years and sometimes would be as long as 3. By the later stages of Pacific whaling, they would sometimes become 4 and even longer. And, you know, we have such a hard time juggling family and work. I mean, can you imagine living in a society where the young men, most of the male population, is gone for years at a time? Returns for a few months to say hi to the wife and kids, and then off they go.
Yeah.
And the women, as a result, on Nantucket ran many of the businesses, had a level of responsibility that was unusual for anywhere else in America. And they developed this society that was that enabled them to carry on this very challenging lifestyle. And, you know, there's a tendency to on Nantucket to, you know, we're proud of that tradition in that, you know, there were strong women on Nantucket. There was attitudes that were way ahead of their time. But the reality was it was a lifestyle built around a very sad domestic situation where, you know, your young boy at 14, that was the age of Thomas Nickerson, the cabin boy on the Essex, whose narrative was a very big help to me in writing the book. He went off at 14 and, you know, and typically you'd come back at 16, 17, maybe 18 years old. This was their high school. And unrecognizable virtually to the family, and then they'd go off again. And that's how that was life on Nantucket in the 19th century.
Women got addicted to opium in some cases. And you even tell the story. We don't need to say too much about it because it might be dicey to talk too much about, but the He's at Homes, these were essentially Nantucket vibrators. I mean, if you didn't have access to your husband, I mean, I guess you had to figure something out.
Well, you know, I mean, every generation thinks they've invented sex and that, you know, it never happened beforehand. But our very presence is kind of indicating that people have been doing this for a long time. Yeah. And, you know, there's just – think of the amount of separation these families endured. And you know, they had to come up with – they were handling it the best they could and the only way they could. And, you know, there is a tendency, I think, to – oh, they – To sanitize the past of all of those, you know, urges that we don't want to talk about necessarily, but they were there. It was a challenge sometimes to provide, you know, find evidence and things like that. But there is tangible evidence, and these were human beings. And once again, I think, you know, it's ultimately a very sad story in that these people, Nantucket was one of the wealthiest towns in America at its peak. But at what cost? You know, to the families, to the children, to everyone. And but this is kind of the story of America. This is, you know, to get ahead is to become an American.
Interesting paradox going on in this story. We talked a little bit about class and how the Nantucket, the islanders looked, askance at the off-islanders is how they put them. And this class structure really played out on the Essex, of course, and on all whaling ships, I suppose. But the race part is really interesting because there were four African-Americans aboard the Essex. And it's interesting on one hand, and I guess this was the Quaker influence. They were equally paid, maybe not equally treated, but there's an interesting paradox here.
Yeah. This was a Quaker island. And in fact, Frederick Douglass, his first speech before a white audience would be at the Nantucket Athenaeum, our public library. And, Quakerism brought a lot of tolerance in that regard. But these Quakers were, as Melville said, Quakers with a vengeance. They were very good at making money, very good at exploiting their workforce. And, you know, given the kind of class system that worked on Nantucket, which you've alluded to, is, you know, if you were from Nantucket, you were part of a special breed. And you were fast-tracked when it came to whaling if you had the skills to become a whaling captain and ultimately potentially a very wealthy person. If you weren't from Nantucket, it was you didn't have any of that access to rising through the ranks. And so there was this – on any ship from Nantucket, there was this great divide between those from the island and those who were off-islanders who were someone from the Cape was known as a koof, which, as the name suggests, was not a positive term. And when it came to the African-American side of things, you know, it's interesting. Initially, the cheap labor supply for Nantucket's whaling industry came from the Native Americans. Over the years, their population declined. There was a devastating epidemic in 1763. That came close to wiping out that population. And many of the survivors ended up moving to Cape Cod and to Martha's Vineyard. And so that it was a not much of a native presence on Nantucket in the 19th century. And African Americans would come to Nantucket partly because of the Quaker influence, but also because there are jobs. And so the four African Americans on the Essex, however, had come from Boston, so they had no island ties. And you know, I think it's of significance that none of the African Americans would survive the ordeal of the Essex, yeah. And that the only men to get out of those whale boats alive were from Nantucket.
Well, this was a – we'll probably come back to this, but maybe it – just since you mention it, this was something that troubled the Quaker population when people were telling the story after they had heard it, that the four African Americans were the first to be eaten in that act of cannibalism.
Yeah, you know, this was not a great story from the position of the Nantucket Chamber of Commerce. this was, you know, about as horrific a situation as possible. Imagine it. You know, this is whaling. Yeah. The thought that the whale could turn the whalemen into the prey turned their world completely upside down. And then to have the survivors reduced to cannibalism, you know, and then one of the great ironies that hovers over the story is after the whale sunk the ship, the men had the option of going with the prevailing breezes to the islands to the west, to the Marquesas or to Tahiti. They would have been there in a matter of weeks, well within the time limit provided by the amount of supplies they could store in their little boats.
Right.
But they didn't know much about the islands at this time. This was very early in Pacific whaling. In just months and years, those islands would become the provisioning ground of the Nantucket whale ship, their backyard. But in 1820— when the Essex sank, they didn't know much at all about these islands except for rumors of cannibals,
right.
Cannibals. So they decided rather than go to – and when you're in a survival situation, it's your fears that drive you. Mm-hmm. And so rather than go into an unknown island with rumors of cannibalism hovering over them
– one of which was Tahiti, by the way.
Right.
Yeah.
The paradise of you know, so many things. And they went on this impossible voyage against the wind, ultimately traveling more than 3,000 miles, and in the great and horrible irony of the story, being reduced to enacting their own worst fears, being reduced to survival cannibalism.
Nathaniel Philbrick is with us, the author of the book In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex. If you haven't read it, you should read it. It's really great. It was published in 2000. It's been made into a major motion picture directed by Ron Howard. The film is set to be released later this week. We will take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Nathaniel Philbrick is with us to tell the tragedy of the whale ship Essex. It's one of the great stories of American history, and there's a good excuse to talk about it. A movie of Philbrick's book, In the Heart of the Sea, is opening this week. Nathaniel Philbrick is joining us from the studios of Carnegie Hall in New York City to talk about it. Well, I wanted to – let's get to the attack. So there were we'll set this up for us, I guess. This is was the whale really 85 feet long?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. When I was researching it, the whale was this great mystery. And the more I learned about a sperm whale, the more I realized sperm whales are still a great mystery.
Yeah.
But, oh, my goodness. There, you know, I didn't read up as much as I could and interviewed one of the great cetologists, Hal Whitehead, who had years ago taken a sailboat, equipped it with very sophisticated electronic sounding gear so he could listen to how whales communicate, which is through a series of Morse code-like clicks and clacks, and had actually sailed the very waters where the Essex went down. And so, you know, this guy knew as much as anyone about the behavior of the sperm whale and how they communicate. And you know, I asked him you know, what he thought had happened and you know, talked about the whale. And he said, you know, I have never in all my experience seen a whale that came close to 85 feet long.
Right.
He had a hard time in envisioning it. And yet, at the Nantucket Whaling Museum is the jaw of an 85-foot sperm whale that was taken by a Captain Cash. And it was, you know, so huge, it's still there for everyone to see that P.T. Barnum tried to purchase it for his Ripley, believe it or not, like Hall of Curiosities. Luckily, the Nantucketers refused to sell. But there is tangible proof that a whale of this size does exist. And the Essex was a pretty small whale ship. It was 85 feet long. The ship that's in the movie is almost exactly that same length. And you know, you put an 85-foot sperm whale against an 85-foot ship, it's about a ton per foot when it comes to the whale. So this is an 85-ton creature. And, you know, what it can do to the ship is amazing. And in talking with Ron Howard and some of the production people, you know, they created a model of a whale, and then through computer generated effects, worked it out. And you know, they were just horror. You know, when they started to play with it, they, you know, it was just amazing to them, the power of what this whale could do. And if you see it in the movie, it really makes it visually and viscerally alive. And so this was a big whale.
Yeah.
They said it was 85 feet. I think these guys had a pretty good sense of how long it was, because at one point in its the whale hit the ship on its side, on the port side, went underneath the ship, not knocking it back and forth as if it was in the midst of an earthquake, and then surfaced, head towards the bow, tail towards the stern, right beside the ship. So they had a real opportunity to literally measure the whale relative to the ship. And so I think they had a pretty accurate idea of how big this whale was. The whale would spring back to life, by now was a very angry sperm whale, and would ram the bow of the ship and sink it. And, you know, so I was given the evidence that we have, I think there were whales of this size. I think after more than 100 years of hunting, looking for the largest whales possible, because the larger the whale, the more oil it would produce,
right,
they may have effectively reduced the size of bull sperm whales, because it's the bull sperm whale are the big ones.
Right.
And today, no one has ever seen one that big, but we do have evidence that they once were that large.
Do you think you have a good sense of why it was this whale? Generally, these are serene creatures. Why it would have done that? I mean, you know, was it crazy? Was it? And there was this big question, of course, because what was going on at the time was they had the whale boats were in the water, and they had harpooned two.
Yep.
It was the big bull sperm whale acting to protect the others, or acting angry? I mean, do we have a sense of what really happened that day?
Well, you know, that was the big question I had. You know, what was the whale thinking?
Yeah.
And to tell the truth, Owen Chase and the other crew members were thinking exactly that, because this had never happened before in the history of American whaling. You know, we think of whales as passive creatures, but bull sperm whales are a lot like bull elephants. When it comes to a typical pod of whales is largely females and juveniles, and the males are solitary,
right,
and go from pod to pod. They must confront the dominant male that's with the pod and fight it out. So these bull sperm whales are typically battle scarred from these kinds of confrontations. So, you know, they have an aggressive ability built into them. And, you know, and I referred to you earlier that, you know, they communicate with
right,
clicks and clacks.
Yeah.
That when then the whalemen would hear them through the timbers of their ships, and they sounded so much like the tapping of a hammer that they called them the carpenter fish,
right,
for sperm whales. And One of my theories is that we know when this big bull first appeared and rammed into the side of the Essex, Owen Chase was repairing a whaleboat that had been hit by the tail of a whale, opened up, forcing them to row back to the ship. They pulled it up onto the deck, and Chase was nailing a patch in place over the broken part of the canvas, over the broken part of the vessel. And one of my theories was Chase unintentionally sending a signal to this big bull sperm whale by hammering away on the deck of the Essex? And, you know, did this whale see the ship as potentially another bull? You know, who knows?
Right.
I wondered,
it's a possibility.
Does that theory hold up 15 years later? Has anyone tested it in the time being?
Yeah, no, not that I know of. No. I haven't talked to anyone who's tested that. But it's interesting. In the movie, they pretty much go with that theory, and it's very effectively done in terms of, you know, what was the whale thinking? When you watch the movie, this whale is you know, you understand where he's coming from. And for me, it was, you know, very satisfying to sort of see it as it is presented in the movie.
Nathaniel Philbrick is with us. His book, In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex. The movie by the same name is opening this weekend, directed by Ron Howard. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Nathaniel Philbrick. We're talking about his classic book, In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex, which is now a major motion picture directed by Ron Howard, which is going to be released later this week. Do you have a sense, do you think, because you try to convey this clearly, of what it's like to come this close to dying of thirst? What's that like?
It's not pretty. And I have to say the research for this book was very difficult on a personal level. You know, it's about the worst kind of suffering you can experience. And finding the evidence was you know, harrowing. And all sorts of tales of people at sea, in the desert, you know, what you go through. And what happens is your body is dehydrated. You know, it's what water you have goes to the vital organs, and it gets to the point where your tongue becomes this described as a wooden thing, something that almost rattles in your mouth when you try to speak, and ultimately you can't speak anymore. And the other thing is your eyes. It can get to the point where you don't have tears. It's almost tears of blood coming from your eyes. It's a horrible. It's much worse than starvation in terms of a way to suffer. And initially when these men took to the whale boats, it was they didn't have enough water, and that was what was getting them. And as Chase said, you know, it's of all the human sufferings, and every one of these men experienced just about every version of suffering you can experience. Thirst is the worst, and you know, they were surrounded by water. They would attempt to drink some of the salt water, their own urine. Which didn't really seem to help at all, and in fact, the salt water was really bad for them, and these men were tremendously disciplined, and they seemed to hold it together remarkably well, and lo and behold, they just as they were within days, if not hours, of beginning to collectively succumb to dehydration, they stumbled upon an island, Henderson Island. More than 2,000 miles off the coast of South America, where they found fresh water literally bubbling from a rock. I mean, this is biblical.
It is biblical
in terms of the story. And you know, and the amazing thing is that it was only it was only visible at dead low tide.
Yeah.
So they only had a few hours of water, but they had some casks and they filled it up, and they had finally had, they were not going to die of dehydration. What they would later find out is when the men blew through all the resources on the island, there were birds' eggs, and you know, they were like locusts descending upon the resources of this tiny island. And within days, it became clear that there would be nothing left if they stayed there. It's, you know, a real metaphor for a man and resources in a limited, in a small planet. They realized they'd have to leave. Well, and three of the men, significantly, all three of them from off island, looked around them and said, "We don't want to be on these whale boats with this group of Nantucketers." And they decided to stay. And what they discovered was that the only reason that rock, which bubbled forth with water, was available to them was because they were at moon low tide. Once the men, most of the men left in their whale boats, they couldn't get to the water again. And when they were finally rescued, and they were rescued, they were on the verge of dying of dehydration. And so it's not the way you want to go.
There's one of the most affecting moments in the story is when a ship comes upon the whale boat that contains George Pollard.
Yeah.
Remind me of the one who's with him.
Barzilla Ray.
Right, Barzilla Ray. And they are...
No, I'm sorry. Barzilla Ray... I'm sorry. Ramsdale is
Ramsdale,
the one
that's right. That's Ramsdale. And they are in a condition, of course, because they've practically starved to death and practically died of thirst. And, of course, they have cannibalized some of their shipmates. And they are literally sucking the marrow out of the bones.
Yeah.
And these bones become this obsession. And it's such a... such a powerful sort of moment in story. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, it's the image I really start the book with, of a Nantucket whale ship, the Dauphin, coming upon this whale boat in the, you know, just out there, well off the coast of Chile, and that's clearly been through hell, and rigged as a small schooner. No men visible, and they sailed up to it, looked down, and there were Pollard and Ramsdale sucking the bones of their dead shipmates, which the captain who found them said they were loath to part with. You know, they were in a state barely cognizant, crazy basically, unwilling to let go of their crew members' bones. And you know, this is just, you know, obviously a horrific thing to see, even worse to experience. And the amazing thing is that they would bring Pollard and Ramsdale aboard, and that night the whale ship that rescued them would have a gam, get together with a couple of other whale ships, and the captains would all get together, and Pollard would somehow find the strength to tell them all what of his ordeal. And Pollard apparently was an amazing man. He told them, he pulled no punches, described how they were rammed by a whale, where they went, and you know, described in painstaking detail how he presided over the drawing of lots with himself and his three young crew members, because they had reached the point that if they didn't do something, they would all starve to death. That one person, it's known as the custom of the sea. You draw lots to see who should be sacrificed so the rest should live. And the lot came to his much younger cousin, Owen Coffin, who was shot by his friend Barzilla Ray and consumed. And he told this story with unflinching you know, he just laid it out there, and one of the captains was Captain Paddock. He would write down this account. It's a virtual transcript of of this remarkable account. I think the Rime of the Ancient Mariner comes to mind, really.
Right.
And that a copy of that letter would be handed from ship to ship, and that would be the first account to make its way to Nantucket. And I think it's a real tribute to Pollard. He had suffered so much, but he hid nothing.
Yeah, I have to say, everyone talks about Owen Chase as being kind of the main character of the story, and I'm not sure how it plays out in the film, though I have a suspicion. But I really like George Pollard as a character, because what's so interesting about him is, as you tell in the book, he's given a second chance. He goes out, and there he encounters another disaster on a ship,
yeah.
And he becomes unlucky. He can't do it anymore. But as opposed to sort of disappearing into despair and depression, he doesn't. He becomes, I don't know if happy, but certainly a cheerful fixture in Nantucket, kind of a beloved character.
Yeah, he became the town night watchman.
Yeah.
And, and as a watchman, it was your job to get in the young, frolicking kids.
Right.
And tie, at the end of the day, in the evening. I found an account of a relative who ended up spending, he was an orphan, and spent time with the Pollards, living with them. They never had any children. And he recounts how that on every November 20th, which is the day of the sinking of the Essex, Pollard would lock himself in his room and fast in memory of those who had died. And, just an amazing thing. And I think the ultimate character reference comes from none other than Herman Melville.
Absolutely.
Melville visited the island the summer after writing Moby Dick. Can you imagine that?
Mm.
And was staying at an inn just across the street from where Pollard lived. And in his copy of Owen Chase's narrative of the whale ship Essex, Melville would write late in life in green crayon because his vision had begun to go. At some time in the 1850s, I was on Nantucket, met Captain Pollard. To the islanders, he was a nobody, but to me, one of the most remarkable men I have ever met.
You write in your book, and we have talked about this before, why read Moby Dick? You write about how Melville encountering Pollard, and this is how you put it. You said, Pollard seemed like a revelation to Melville that this idea, and here's how you put it in your book, that life isn't about achieving your dreams. It's about finding a way to continue on in spite of them. I guess that was a real insight for Melville.
Well, and it was Moby Dick was his own version of the Essex disaster,
right.
Pollard was blasted by fate not once but twice. Melville would write what we regard as one of American literature's greatest novels, but it would be virtually the end of his career as a professional writer. The critics hated it, did not do well with the public. His career would take a downward spiral from there in terms of the popularity of his books. He still was a great writer in his own right, but this was the end of his career, and I think for him, and he would write a poem late in life called Clairel, which has a character based on Pollard, and I think he wrote this late in life when his own career was in shambles, and I think from Pollard he found a kind of archetype of someone who had experienced the worst that life can throw at you.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than giving up, continued to lead a noble life.
Let me ask you, how did Nantucket at the time talk about this? Apparently they didn't talk about it for
yeah.
a long while. And then also tell me how they talk about it today.
Yeah, well, the topic of the Essex was not anything that people were proud of.
Right.
There's this account of a woman in the late 19th century, a young girl asking her aunt, what is the Essex? I heard someone talking about the Essex. And the aunt said, Miss Molly, we do not talk about the Essex on Nantucket. And, I think it was something they just soon not broadcast. And today, the Essex, I think it's my book has probably had something to do with it. But, you know, I am by no means the first person to write about this. There's Moby Dick and others who have written nonfiction accounts of it. You know, it's funny. On Nantucket, we're proud of our whaling heritage. But I don't think there's a group of people on the planet who have more reverence for whales today. You know, we have stranding teams that are doing incredible work as far as not only whales but seals and things like that. And, you know, so it's a very, you know, I find evocative and fascinating interplay of our past and where we are in the present as far as an island at sea. And with a past, but a story that I think has so much instructional value when it comes to how we're going to deal with the future.
It made me wonder if you have more hope for Moby Dick, because that is why you wrote Why Read Moby Dick, because you were kind of worried that it was going to fall by the wayside as a book of American literature. Do you think stories like this will get us thinking about it, reading it again?
I hope so. You know, because Moby Dick is it's a book that so many people have been forced to read when they didn't want to read it,
right.
and that's about the worst thing you can do. It's a book to come to on your own terms. You know, Melville was 31 when he wrote it, which is for me now incredibly young. But right. I think you know life experience is something that's needed in for this book because there's so much of life in it. You know, it's a difficult book. And so, yeah, I do worry about, you know, where it will go. But I think, you know, it's such a part of our culture. It's a story that speaks to a society on the verge of catastrophe. And I think as we all know better now than ever, that our society will always be on the edge of a catastrophe.
It's Nathaniel Philbrick. He's the author of the book Why Read Moby Dick? And, of course, In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex. And the film, now a major motion picture, is opening this weekend. He joined us from the studios of Carnegie Hall in New York City. Nathaniel Philbrick, thank you again for taking the time.
Oh, it's been great fun. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Today on Video West, we're premiering a short documentary about Josh Hanegarny. He's a writer and a librarian in Salt Lake City who's written beautifully about his experiences with Tourette syndrome. We had him on Radio West a few years ago to talk about his book, The World's Strongest Librarian, and you should go see the short that we've produced at videowest.org. Radio West, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.